This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Robert Bryce has written a new book called Cronies: Oil, the Bushes, and the Rise of Texas, America's Superstate. The book traces how Texas politicians and Texas corporations have taken leading roles in America's energy policy and foreign policy, including the war in Iraq. Bryce says this book grew out of the research for his first book, Pipe Dreams: Greed, Ego, and the Death of Enron. Bryce lives in Austin.
I think a lot of people are aware of the fact that the first President Bush, the second President Bush, Vice President Cheney have all had connections to the energy business. They've all worked in the energy business. I did not know, perhaps a lot of other people did, but I did not know that James Baker, who was Secretary of State under the first President Bush and directed the Florida recount for the second President Bush, has also been very connected to the energy business, and as a former Texan who was very close with George H.W. Bush even before he became president.
Well, and it's interesting to me because Baker, in terms of his power now as former Secretary of State, is perhaps the most powerful former Secretary of State in America. And his family's law firm, which he is now affiliated with, Baker Botts, has always represented the energy business in Texas, and before the energy business, the big railroads. And now Baker Botts represents ExxonMobil. They represent Occidental Petroleum. They represent ConocoPhillips. And Baker has all of these intertwining relationships with all of these different energy interests, while at the same time, President Bush has appointed him as the envoy to deal with Iraq's debt. So, you know, he's in this case, it seems to me, he's wearing a lot of hats, and we don't, in many cases, we don't know who he's representing.
Well, one of the companies that James Baker represents is Halliburton.
That's right. And in fact, before Halliburton went to Baker Botts, they were represented by Vinson and Elkins, which was another old line Houston law firm, very powerful, very well connected with the state's energy interests, and also was a key backer of Lyndon Johnson. And in 2002, after a lot of the Enron mess hit, Halliburton fired Vinson and Elkins and hired Baker Botts. And so, again, what is, you know, all these different relationships, when you start looking at them, you see, okay, well, there's a Baker Botts lawyer, a man named Robert Jordan, just stepped down as the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia. We have Baker working on the issue of Iraq's debt, and we have Halliburton working in both countries in very profitable contracts, and yet we can't find out what these lawyers are doing, who, you know, what they're representing, who they're talking to, and they're clearly not interested in discussing it.
How did James Baker and the first President Bush become close?
They met, according to all the sources that I can find, on the tennis courts at the Houston Country Club. They were met there, became social friends, and then became political allies. Baker was a key player in George H.W. Bush's first run for political office when he ran for the U.S. Senate in 1964. And now they've been friends for going on 50 years. And throughout, when you look at the history of both the older George Bush and the younger George Bush, Baker Botts, Baker's law firm, has continually played important roles. When the elder George Bush was in the energy business in Zapata, the law firm that represented them was Baker Botts. When George W. Bush had problems with the Securities and Exchange Commission, the law firm that represented him was Baker Botts. In fact, it was Robert Jordan, who then George W. Bush later appointed to be the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia. When the Florida recount came around in 2000, again, it was Baker Botts. Baker became the lead player, but he also brought in key lawyers, key trial lawyers from Baker Botts, who then immediately went to Florida and argued several key cases that helped turn the tide for Bush.
When George H.W. Bush first entered politics and ran for the Senate in 1964, he was then chair of Zapata Offshore Oil Company, which is based in Houston. How much did his early campaigns rely on oil money?
Well, it was the key to his ability to even run for office. I interviewed former Texas Governor Bill Clements, who was also in the drilling business. In fact, Clements and George H.W. Bush were partners in energy ventures in the Persian Gulf, in Kuwait, and in Iran in the early 1960s. When I was interviewing Clements, I'd looked at some of the old campaign finance reports about Bush's funders for that 1964 race, and I saw that Clements had given him several tens of thousands of dollars. And I asked him about it, and he said, oh, no, I gave him way more than that. I said, well, how much did you give him? He said, I gave him $500,000. And I said, well, Governor, you realize that in today's money, that's $3.5 million. He says, I know. But, you know, he, for him, it was that was just part of the being in the energy business, that he was a man with deep pockets, and he wanted someone who was going to go to Congress and protect the depletion allowance, who was going to look out for the Texas energy interests. And in 1966, when Bush won a seat in Congress, it's exactly what he did.
What were the energy interests at the time? What did the oil companies in Texas want?
Well, they wanted to make sure that the depletion allowance stayed in place. This was a special tax break that was only given to the energy producers that allowed them to take 27.5% of the income that they got off of a given well or wells and get all of that income tax-free. It was a tax break that was unique to the energy industry that Eastern interests and Democrats had been lobbying against for decades. Ever since it was passed in the early 1900s, and they fought it for years. They finally got it repealed in 1975, but throughout, particularly the 40s, 50s, 60s, and early 70s, the depletion allowance was a key factor in the ability of Texas energy interests to have huge amounts of disposable cash that they could then use to fund their favored politicians.
I think you're right. They were also interested in an oil import quota to protect Texas oil prices.
They were, and you know, now particularly, it's remarkable to look back at the import quota, because the issue now is, you know, we are so reliant on imported oil. Well, during the Nixon administration, George Bush the first was trying to make sure that imported oil was kept at bay, because he wanted to this was another way to protect domestic energy producers. The Texas producers in particular, although their oil was abundant, they could not produce it as cheaply as oil that was coming from, say, Saudi Arabia or Kuwait or Venezuela. So in the 1950s, during the Eisenhower administration, they placed an import quota that restricted the amount of cheap imported oil that could be brought into the U.S., and that in effect, helped keep domestic prices up for domestic producers, and that was hugely important. And in fact, during the Nixon administration, there was much discussion of repealing this quota, and George Bush, the first, led the fight to keep the import quota in place.
George W. Bush was in the oil business before entering politics. Did his father's contacts help him get established in oil?
Oh, of course. I mean, I think this has been very well established that when George W. Bush landed in Midland, one of the first things he did was go to his father's crony network and appeal to them for money that he could then use to begin drilling for oil in Arbusto and his other ventures, Harkin and so on. Those contacts that he had through his father and also through friends of James A. Baker III were key in his ability to raise the money that he needed to get going in the oil business.
Who were some of the Texas friends and businessmen who most helped him in his election campaign?
Well, Enron, the people from Enron clearly figure throughout. When Bush began running for the U.S. or for the governorship of Texas, one of his first visits was to Houston, and there he talked to Rich Kinder, who was at that time the president of Enron. He was Jeff Skilling's predecessor at Enron. Bush went to Kinder and asked him if Kinder would be his finance chair in Harris County. Now, this is critically important because Houston is the biggest city in the state, and it is a huge source for political funds. Kinder was in the energy business. He was at Enron, which is a thriving company at that time in late 93, early 94. And Kinder agreed. And, you know, from that time then until I think just earlier this year, Enron was George W. Bush's biggest career patron. And they in total gave him something on the order of $700,000. And Texans for Public Justice has done studies on this and found that by far and away, the industry that gave the most money as a percentage of George W. Bush's total giving was the energy business.
I mean, should there be any surprise in that? I mean, after all, Texas is famous for its energy business, and all politicians rely on businesses in their state to help them rise in office.
Of course. But I think that now the energy business is the most important. It produces the most important commodity in the world economy. They are an expansionist business that by nature. They are always, you know, going into new markets. They are always expanding their businesses overseas. It is not in any way surprising that these companies would be supporting the Bushes and other conservative politicians. What is remarkable, I think, and very worthy of note, is how this universe of energy people is very small. And the key people who have been key players throughout the Bush family's rise in politics, like Ray Hunt, like James Baker, like personnel who are associated with Halliburton. It is a very small universe, and we keep seeing the same faces over and over. And I think it raises the question, well, where does business begin and where does politics begin? And I think what we see in many of these cases is simply that politics and business have merged, and I think that's dangerous.
My guest is Robert Bryce. He's the author of the new book, Cronies, Oil, the Bushes, and the Rise of Texas, America's Superstate. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Bryce. His new book is called Cronies, Oil, the Bushes, and the Rise of Texas, America's Superstate. You, in talking about whether oil played a part in the decision to invade Iraq, you cite a report from 2001 that was put together by the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy at Rice University in conjunction with the Council on Foreign Relations. The report was titled Strategic Energy Policy Challenges for the 21st Century. What do you find most relevant about this report in looking ahead to the invasion of Iraq?
Well, I think what's remarkable about it is how similar some passages in that report are spot on with the agenda that was being promoted by the neocons, the neoconservatives. In specific, there was a passage in there that said that Saddam Hussein was a threat to the flow of oil to international markets. That passage is remarkable because other people that I talked to in the energy business were saying, well, no, he wasn't a threat. Yes, we knew he was abusing the UN oil for food program. We knew that he was withholding oil when it suited him. But the amount of oil that was being produced in Iraq at that time, you know, a million and a half barrels of oil a day, was not that significant in terms of overall world production. So it seemed to me, and the reason I brought that up was that one was the Baker affiliation, and the Baker Institute gets a huge amount of its funding from the energy business, but also that it was so in line with what the neocons were saying, particularly in terms of we've got to get rid of Saddam, we have to consider all of our military options, and so on.
Well, getting back to the question of whether the invasion of Iraq was connected to the oil industry or not, let's say hypothetically it was, and that the oil industry wanted to overthrow Saddam Hussein. What would they gain by that?
Well, I don't necessarily see it in those same terms. I think the issue is more about controlling the flow of oil. We don't want to own the oil. And I don't suggest that any of the oil companies, in fact, Lee Raymond, the CEO of Exxon, recently said that they're not interested in getting into Iraq now because the situation there is so unstable. The broader issue for the United States is being able to control the flow of oil out of the Persian Gulf. We don't need to own it. We just need to make sure that the flow happens unimpeded, that there is no restriction on the flow of oil. So that's more the key issue. I don't think that there's some industry cabal where, you know, the big energy guy said, we need to invade Iraq and take over the oil. I think it's simply a strategic issue for the United States over the long term to assert control or some authority over the oil that's in the Persian Gulf, because it is, as George H.W. Bush said in his 91 security directive, it is vital to U.S. national security. Our economy depends on that oil.
And isn't that an argument for saying perhaps that, you know, we're lucky there are so many oil industry people in the Bush administration, since oil is a security issue and these guys know the business, they will represent our security interests in knowing what is best for oil, and oil is in our security interest.
Fine, I take your point. But so let's call a spade then. Then let's stop talking about, you know, these other issues in terms of spreading democracy in the Mideast. Let's admit that we have a strategic interest there and we can't do anything about it. Or at the same time, if we can admit that and say publicly, yeah, we have to control this oil. We have to be concerned about the situation in Saudi Arabia, because if we aren't ready to invade, then our economy is going to be severely hurt. So What I guess I'm looking for is just some more truth in advertising here. If this is our strategic interest, let's admit it. And then furthermore, and I think most importantly, let's do something about our energy situation. Can we reduce this reliance on the Persian Gulf? Can we ameliorate it somehow with further efficiency or renewable efforts here in the U.S. or developing other sources? I mean, I think that this begs the question of, you know, can we really as a nation now face the facts in terms of what our interests are in the Persian Gulf? Because we're stuck now. We can't stay and we can't leave. And that's a bad place to be.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Bryce. He's the author of the new book, Cronies, Oil, the Bushes, and the Rise of Texas, America's Super State. What were some of the challenges you faced in researching this book, Cronyism, about oil and politics in Texas and how that's affected presidents like LBJ and the two President Bushes?
Well, I mean, the key one was access. You know, neither George H.W. Bush would talk to me. James A. Baker III refused my interview request, so I was forced to essentially, you know, ambush him in an interview and ask the few questions that I could. Generally, power people in power and people who have these kinds of relationships don't want to talk about them. They will, you know, generally only talk with, you know, journalists that they perceive will be, you know, very friendly to their interests, very friendly to their position. And, you know, I didn't go in there promising that I was going to soft pedal any questions. When I asked for an interview with George H.W. Bush, I made it very clear I wanted to talk with him about the Carlyle Group, and I wanted to talk with him about his involvement with business interests in Saudi Arabia. So I wasn't hiding at all what my agenda was or what my questions would be. And so, no, it's not surprising at all that they didn't want to talk.
How much investigation were you able to do into the Carlyle Group?
Well, the Carlyle Group to me is interesting, but it's not the evil empire. It's important because it is perhaps, you know, among these major investment banks, major venture capital firms, I guess, merchant banks, it is perhaps the best example of the cronyism that, you know, is now infesting our government. It is important. It's an important part of the story. But the part about the Carlyle Group that to me is interesting goes back to James Baker. That is that as Bush's debt envoy for Iraqi debt, Baker goes to Saudi Arabia to talk to the Saudis because the Saudis hold more Iraq debt than any other country. Baker had previously been to Saudi Arabia with the elder George Bush in an effort to raise money, investment funds from wealthy Saudis to invest in the Carlyle Group. And apparently they were successful because Prince Bandar and several other very prominent Saudis later invested in the Carlyle Group. Fast forward to, you know, recent months when Baker goes to Saudi Arabia to talk about the issue of debt. Well, who's he representing there? He's still working for the Carlyle Group. He's now representing talking to the Saudis about debt relief. But at the same time, we don't know what his own personal financial holdings are, because when Bush appointed him, he appointed him as a special governmental employee. And as such, Baker's financials, his personal financials, were not disclosed. And in fact, were only disclosed to the White House General Counsel's office. So he goes to Saudi Arabia wearing the hat of the U.S. government, maybe wearing the hat of the Carlyle Group, which does huge amounts of business in Saudi Arabia through United Defense, which is one of its subsidiaries. But again, we can't know what are Baker's other interests while he's doing this job for George W. Bush.
Your previous book was about Enron and its collapse. How does that book and this book connect? You say in your introduction that this book grew out of writing that one.
Well, after finishing Pipe Dreams, I started thinking, well, what was it about Enron? Why did this company have so much political power? What was it that made it such an extraordinarily politically potent entity? And I puzzled over it for months trying to think, okay, well, what is it that has made Texas powerful? What is it that has made Texas such a dominant player in American politics? And, you know, I just kept coming back to the energy slice of it, that in fact, pretty much every Texas politician of note of the last 50 years has had major connections to the energy business. And so that was the genesis of it. Once I started puzzling over it and thinking, well, what about all these other industries? I realized Enron would never have been the powerhouse that it was had it been in the candy business or in something else. And it was in the energy business and it was in Houston. And those were key parts of its ability to wield power.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Robert Bryce is the author of Cronies, Oil, the Bushes, and the Rise of Texas, America's Superstate. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.